Welcome in to the Odds and Audibles podcast. I'm Matt Preem, Eric Scopel on today's show, and we've got our dancing shoes on. Eric, I also have a surprise for you off camera real quick. I stole a game ball from the Pac-12 network, or from the Pac-12 conference. Coming from Vegas, Oregon has won their way into the Pac-12 tournament. I don't think anyone saw this coming. I certainly didn't at the start of the tournament. When they went to Vegas and had to play UCLA in the quarterfinal round. But as the days went on, it became more of a possibility. And then beating Arizona, I don't know about you, Eric. Once they beat Arizona, I told Nick Ursini of KEZI, who was there, John Canzano, who was there, and also Will Patterson, Oregon's SID, before the Colorado game, I said, it didn't matter who they were going to play. After they beat Arizona, they were going to win on Saturday. Dana Altman teams historically don't lose that. You know, they get to the title game and they're there. They're not playing Arizona. They're in the title game. They're going to win. And sure enough, they did. It's a heck of a turnaround. They're 23-11. They've been given an 11 seed. They head to the Midwest region. They're going to play South Carolina, who's a 6 seed. A potential matchup if they can pull off the upset against Dana Altman's former university, Creighton, looms at large. We're gonna talk a lot more about the tournament later this week. We'll do some of it today, but there's so much to recap of what has happened this season, what has happened in the last 2 weeks, and some of it has been unbelievable basketball that, quite frankly, we haven't seen before from an individual perspective from some guys on this team.
Yeah, I wanted to go into Dante's big Saturday, but I have to ask you, was that was a game ball that was used in one of the games?
This is, if you remember the balls, go watch Pac-12 Network or go watch the Fox broadcast. The ball looks orange. This is like an orange-ish basketball, and it's got the Pac-12 logo on it. It's an actual game ball. It's not the one that they used in the championship game, but this was on the floor in Vegas for the last Pac-12 tournament in some capacity.
Look at that. Now it's going to be framed and put up somewhere in the Preem household. Perfect.
Yeah. I find ways to get stuff. I have the very first board of the Pac-12 tournament when they won it in 2013. Right. I tried to get this one in 2024. It had Oregon's put as the champion, but it was like supersized from what it was in 2013. Oh. And I could no longer get it on the airplane, so I left it in Vegas. Oh, well, so I got a ball instead.
So you settled. You know who didn't settle at all, and this is a terrible transition, but maybe a good one, and Folly Dante. And that was exactly – you kind of alluded to it because I think that's where we were going to go immediately before I realized you had procured one of the game balls. I think this is a good place to start. Where does Enfali Dante's 12 for 12, 25.9 rebound, 3 steal, 1 block performance stack up amongst the best we've seen, Matt? Because I was thinking about this as the game was going on. Like, the only other time I could think of an Oregon player going perfect from the field was Bryce Taylor back in 2007. I think that was also in the Pac-12 tournament.
Championship game against USC.
Yeah, he went
a lot of those were threes too.
Yeah, he went 11 for 11. I've actually got it pulled up here. He was 11 for 11 in that game. Oregon won by a ton. He had 32 points. He was 7 of 7 from three, also 3 of 3 from the free throw line. It's a different sort of performance in part because
it's a big man.
That's a big man. This is a guy shooting from the perimeter, but regardless, this is like arguably the best individual big man performance, I would say, in school history. And like, you could maybe make the case just because of everything that was at stake here, which was a little different from that team back then, because that team was clearly going dancing. That this one was like maybe more meaningful. I don't know. Like, how have you digested this? Because it's really, really special what we watched on Saturday.
We are seeing in the last couple of weeks what Oregon envisioned in Enfali Dante being as a player and the impact that he could have on a game. when he signed as a five-star recruit and joined Oregon early in the 2019-2020 season. That would be Peyton Pritchard's final year. He played about 17 games that season, had massive tendonitis in his knees. And then the expectation was that sophomore year, the team that actually made it to the Sweet 16 without him, the expectation that he was going to be this superstar big man. And maybe as a junior, he has a huge year and goes pro and leaves early at Oregon. That, you know, go back to just the whole career path and of his 5 year time in Eugene, and when he started staying here longer and longer. We saw Frank Kepnog leave Oregon. We saw Francis Okoro leave Oregon because Dante's emergence, Dante's return, and eventually we saw Khalil Ware leave Oregon. Right. And all of those are tied, I think, to Enfale Dante being at Oregon. He wasn't supposed to be here this long. He's dealt with a ton of injuries, and he's now healthy, and he's playing his best basketball. Against Colorado, yes, the best performance from an Oregon big man that I've seen from an Oregon player. I would argue it's probably the best big man performance with all that was at stake on the line that day, probably in program history from an individual game standpoint. And what Tad Boyle, Colorado head coach, pointed out was after the game was they've played Oregon twice in about 10 days.
Yeah.
And he has scored 45 points. He has shot 22 of 22 from the field. He's grabbed 21 rebounds. He's blocked six shots. He's had six steals. And he has played 68 minutes out of 80 minutes in this game, in these two games. Unbelievable performance, what he did against UCLA, fouling out Kenneth Nuba, getting Adem Bona, who was the Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Year award winner, into foul trouble, how he dominated Arizona in that second half when he came back from injury. And then obviously what he did against Colorado, no reason. It was a shoe-in for him to be named the tournament most outstanding player. And this is why, if Oregon does make a run in the tournament, if they get a game, if they get two games, victories, they're going to win it. They're going to win a game or games in the NCAA tournament because Enfale Dante continues to do what he's doing. And to be honest with you, there's maybe only a handful of guys in the country that have the matchup ability to guard Dante offensively. And, you know, that's going to be Oregon's path to upsets. Is Creighton has a really good big man on their team, and that will be a good matchup for Oregon. But you look at the South Carolina matchup, and, you know, they don't have a player the caliber from a physical standpoint, from a talent standpoint, as Dante. And they're going to have to hope that Enfale Dante continues to play at this high of a level. It's unreasonable to expect him to not miss during the game, but they're going to need this type of a performance where he literally carries you. And I think he can do that. Will he do that? That's to be learned.
Yeah. And we're focusing on the 12 for 12, but some of the defensive impacts,
unbelievable,
were huge. And I the play that obviously is going to be looked at the most was the block on the Simpson three. And then the fact that he was able to trail it, tap it ahead to Shellstat. That's pretty remarkable, by the way, athletic for somebody who's about 7 feet tall, to be able to move like that, to outrace Simpson for the ball and tap it ahead. Like, that was a spectacular play. And as you said, it gives Oregon a chance going into this tournament. You know, I was looking at South Carolina. I think their tallest starter is 6'8". So Oregon will have a size advantage there. It will be very interesting to see. And we're going to talk, I think, more later in the week about the actual South Carolina-Oregon matchup. But Oregon definitely goes into this tournament. There's a reason they're 1.5-point underdogs, despite being a pretty big seed difference with South Carolina in this game. So I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic that, shoot, I don't think Dana Altman has never lost in the opening round of an NCAA tournament, has he?
He has only lost one game in his 14-year career of Pac-12 tournament, NCAA tournament, NIT tournament, or CBI tournament. He's only lost one of the opening game of whatever team he's coaching in postseason play. And that was in the Pac-12 tournament in 2012 against Colorado in the quarterfinal round. They win that game. They're in the tournament. They didn't get it. They got into the NIT. But to answer your question, in the NCAA tournament, they're 7-0. They have won every single game. And to be honest with you, I'd have to look at this from a box score perspective. I don't think any of the games have been even like a two-score game at the end of the game. I think Oregon's kind of won going away every single time.
Gamecocks, be ready. The other part that I think stood out from just this weekend, and we can get more into the in-game stuff, was just Dana and what this meant for him. And, you know, I think it was Don McLean said in one of the post-game shows he had not seen him this animated before. Was that your sense being down there? And then we have to acknowledge, like, after the games, he was beaming. He was a lot more, I'm trying to think of the right way to put it, but like, he was clearly really, really pleased with what had taken place. And a lot of pride was, like, pretty hard to ignore that was something that meant a lot to him this weekend.
He was pretty sentimental after, I believe, the Utah regular season finale on senior day, about how proud he was of his team to get 20 wins. And I know that's a number that 7-8 years ago, it used to be, if you get 20 wins, you were an automatic selection for the NCAA tournament as a Power Six conference. That number is kind of been a little diminished as more games are starting to be played, but it's a stat that this program prides itself on. 14 straight years now, they're well past 20 now, but he was pretty sentimental then about how proud he was for this team to never give in, never to give up, fighting through the injuries and the adversity that they felt. And I think Saturday in Vegas was him publicly kind of like decompressing. Cause I agree with you. Like, I watched some of his interview with Infale Dante on the Pac-12 network show, with Don McLean and Ashley Adamson. And I think a couple other people, and he was actually kind of like ribbing them, like, now you guys picked us. Like,
right.
And he doesn't do that. And you're right. And Don's comment about being animated on the sidelines. I noticed, when the game was over, Jermaine Cousinard had the ball, was going towards Oregon's bench, and went up to Dana, and he started it. He stuck his hand out and did the really hard, like, hand high five slap. And go back in time and watch some of the biggest dunks and biggest blocks and big moments in Oregon history. And he's always been he has showed no emotion. I mean, that's like the biggest thing. One of the things I always joke about Dana Altman is, you know, I remember Jordan Bell throwing a ball off the backboard and dunking it in a game once, and Altman literally had zero emotion. He was literally leaned up against the wall like this, as if a layup had happened. And I think there was a lot of frustration with how the season went. I think there's probably a lot of frustration with how the staff was viewed. And right. They heard the noise of he needs to retire or he needs to get fired. And to win three games in three nights, the teams that they played, the way that they did it, you know, I think there was a lot of pride. I think there was a lot of satisfaction. And we got a glimpse of him celebrating. He actually smiled, which was very rare to see. I have a photo on my phone of him smiling, which is, I think, extremely rare.
No kidding. Well, and to that last point there, last time we recorded a basketball podcast, we're talking about the state of both programs and who needs to be, you know, do these coaches need to be replaced, et cetera. Those were conversations we were having in, what was that, like mid-February? Something like that. And to be where we are now, where it's undeniable he is keeping his job. It's undeniable he deserves to have his job. And it's undeniable, frankly, that people need to shut up about him losing his job, which is, I think, part of why, as you said, he was pretty fired up, and maybe the staff was kind of like, what are we doing here? You know, we've had so much success, so much consistent success. Like, be reasonable with us. This year's been a crazy year from an injury perspective, and obviously for them to overcome that and get to where they are now, it makes sense that they are kind of, you know, strutting around, sticking their chests out a little bit, because it wasn't long ago where you had a pretty vocal contingent of the fan base saying a lot of things that probably didn't sit great with those guys.
We went back and forth on both we had different views with Oregon's men's side than the women's side at that time. But we also acknowledged, like, from the men's side, they weren't good enough. And that we came out and said, like, there needed to be some kind of change. And I don't think neither of us said that Altman needed to be replaced or even any of the assistants needed to be replaced. But the process of how they were operating year in, year out needed to change. And Altman even, has even come out and said the same thing. But you're right. Like, this eliminates any kind of vocalness from a minority of the fan base asking for him to be gone or to retire. Honestly, after the game, Altman was asked post game what it meant to win the first Pac-12 championship and played in Las Vegas, and then to win the league's last overall Pac-12 championship, and his thoughts on the league folding. And he went into a really long speech about how he was really sad and he didn't want the league to end. He, you know, he's going to embrace going to the Big Ten, but his preference was to stay here and to not, you know, he likes the schools. He likes the regionality of the teams that they're playing, the travel, the venues, you know, he brought up how Vegas has been so positive overall for Oregon and for the program. But then he brought up, like, he's also excited for the Big Ten. He's also excited for the new challenge. And I honestly think that in 8, 9, 10, whatever years it's going to be when he retires, we're going to look back at this 2-week stretch, 3-week stretch of beating Utah on the regular season finale to get the 20 wins, securing the top 4 seed in the Pac-12 tournament, then running the table to getting into the NCAA tournament and having the season that, you know, capping off the year, like a guy like Dante had, a guy like Cousinard had, and then we'll see what happens in the tournament. But
yeah,
I think this is going to rejuvenate the program. I think it's going to rejuvenate the fan base, because now all of a sudden you look, I don't want to get too far ahead of the tournament, but next year you've got Shelstead coming back. You've got Kwame Evans coming back. You've got Mookie Cook coming off injury. Nate Biddle is going to be coming off an injury. You've got a couple other guys that could be back on this year's team. You've got a solid recruiting class coming in. Like, now all of a sudden, instead of, oh, it's third year in a row of the NIT, now all of a sudden you've got some core pieces that are exciting. You've got some, you know, some program altering pieces. You're going to the Big Ten. The fan base is going to be back and is going to be really jacked up now because they're part of March. There's going to be a lot of excitement there. And I also think this is going to rejuvenate maybe Dana Altman and some of their coaching staff. I mean, Tony Stubblefield could be coming back. I mean, Altman's like on record, which is just absolutely shocking to me. Like, I'm trying to hire Tony Stubblefield. Yes, we're still talking. And he even admitted it. Like, yeah, I could look like a fool talking about a coach that's not on the staff and he may not come here. And it makes me look like a fool if that happens, but like, that's how bad I want Tony on the staff. I think this is going to rejuvenate the fan base. I also think it's going to rejuvenate Altman a little bit of, not that he ever had doubts or anything like that, but just a new added fire of going into a new league, coming off an NCAA tournament with some guys coming back next season, going into that new league where they're going to be pretty darn good. And I think this might be a turning point where you see this happen sometimes with some coaches that have been at a school for a really long time, where they get a second gear all of a sudden and they, you know, they get going again for a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year stretch. This might be this moment for Altman and his staff.
You certainly got the sense watching him that, I don't know if he was rejuvenated or how you want to put it, but there was just more energy there all the way across the board. You know, and we should note that this is something that I looked up because I was just curious. He's 20th on the NCAA Division I all times wins list. He's won 754 games. The number of active coaches ahead of him, I think it's 3. So
is it Izzo, Self?
He's actually ahead of Izzo, which surprised me.
Really?
It's Bill Self. Rick Barnes is still employed, right?
Yes, Tennessee.
And Rick Pitino. So, I miss John Calipari. So I guess 4, but it's a short list of guys who've had longer careers with more success than Dana Altman. And to your point here, Matt, if he does have this second gust of wind here, you know, kind of figures it out, I brought that point up with the wins because if he has 7-8 more good years in him, I don't know if he does or not, he could retire like top 10, top 8 in the all-time wins list, which that's pretty spectacular for somebody who I don't think nationally gets quite as much attention.
No, he should be a first ballot Hall of Famer whenever he hangs it up. And honestly, it's kind of a little surprising that he's not already in the Hall of Fame, because we have seen active coaches get put in there before. But yeah, it's, I really think that this is going to be a turning point for the program, and it's going to be interesting what the school does, what the program does, what the players do to capture this moment. Because I'll be honest, like, I was so knee deep. And so in Vegas, it was twofold for me. One, I went for work purposes, obviously, and I had a ton of stuff to do, but my family also went with me. So I was kind of the balancing act of like super tunnel vision on the games at hand, watching the games at hand, doing some networking stuff and covering the tournament. And then also the few times I did have some off moments, I was with my family. And you had better, I honestly think you had a better feel for fan perspective of the engagement and the activity and the act, you know, the discussion points of the program. And you said it, like, when I was flying home on Sunday, that the fan base is fired up. And, you know, I think this is one of those moments in time where what Oregon does over the next 6 weeks to capture the interest and build off this momentum surge here could be critical for the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, there's going to be a spike in interest because of the Big Ten. That's naturally going to happen. But now you're throwing on top of it the gas fire of an NCAA tournament. And on top of that, you've got some freshmen and Shellstead and Evans who are pretty darn talented. You got some key pieces coming back next year. This is going to be a critical 6 weeks for how far can you go this season? How far can you extend and follow Dante's career? What can he do to enhance his draft prospects? Rewarding Jermaine Cousinard and the adversity he fought through to get to the tournament and his first time. How long can his season extend? And then, you know, it's how does that impact the fan base's interest? Because we have seen, like, when they're good and they have recognizable pieces, which they have for next year, their fan base can be pretty engaged and the attendance numbers can be really high. And what does Oregon do to capture the fan base, to get them rejuvenated back into this program? It's going to be an important 6 weeks here for Oregon, whether it's tournament play, roster retention, or as the portal opened today. And I wish we had previewed this earlier before on our show notes. You know, Peja Stojakovic's son, Andre, just entered the portal.
Ooh.
Stanford freshman All-American, McDonald's All-American, excuse me. He basically picked Stanford over Oregon, and he fits exactly what Oregon needs for next season from a player perspective. Portal's open. Oregon's going to be working the phones.
I got several thoughts here, but I can't stand the fact that the portal opens right before the NCAA tournament. We have to change this. This is terrible. The fact that, like, Stanford's obviously not in the tournament, but, like, theoretically, you could have guys being contacted by other schools. I know it's tampering, but everyone does it now while they're getting prepared. So they're distracted for their NCAA tournament. I just think this needs to be worked on.
Just like what we went through with football.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to realize really quickly that, oh, pardon my French. Shit, this is bad.
Yeah, put it after the tournament. I don't know, or set it up so teams that are playing can't. I don't know. It needs to be worked on because it's a mess. But I want to go back to your point about kind of capturing the fan base. Like, just to put it into perspective, you know, Oregon opened up spring football, two practices on Thursday and Saturday of this last week. The basketball coverage definitely, like, swallowed up a lot of the interest in the football.
Which that surprises me. I mean, because that's where I'm talking about. Like, I read our stuff for football, what you and Jared did. Look, we're talking basketball here, but go read that content. There's a lot of
please
landing talks. Stein talked, Tosh talked. You guys got into practice twice. Like, there's a lot there. I am shocked that basketball did better than football. Like, that doesn't happen.
Well, and just there's just so, like, all the topics on the message board are basketball, not football right now. And that'll change, I think, when we get back in April, and football is still so far out, but that's not usually the way this goes. So I thought it was a good point that you brought up there. I want to talk about a couple things from just this weekend. I think first, the defensive effort, the kind of, I don't know if it was really that much of a strategic alteration, but some of the zone that they played, especially in the second half against Arizona, like that was one of the better defensive halves I've seen from an Oregon ball club in several years, for sure. I just think defensively they've kind of found their footing, and, you know, they win three games in Vegas in three nights, and they went 13 of 60 from three. Yeah. So, you know, Dante was unstoppable on the block, but offensively, it's not like they were clicking on all cylinders. They were so good defensively, though, that, you know, aside from maybe the first half against Colorado at times, and maybe the first half against Arizona as well, like, it just felt like they kind of bottled everything up and took a lot of things away. And in particular against Arizona, the Caleb Love defense was
terrific.
Was terrific, holding him to whatever it was, two made field goals, like, after he absolutely lit them up both previous games. It was really impressive defensive showings every night.
I asked Dana Altman after the game was over. It felt like they had played a lot of zone. And let me backtrack. I actually asked an assistant coach on the arena floor after they won. I just was talking with them and just said, really feels like you guys played a ton of zone this tournament. And what led to that? And he was like, well, you're right. We played more zone in these three games than we have really probably all season long, over a three-game stretch. And I think that was a huge turning point for Oregon. Dana Altman, post-game, he even came out, and I asked him about it, and he admitted. He's like, I probably should not admit this. I hate admitting this, but I didn't do a good job of teaching – our zone principles and scheming it up to fit our team. And they made some kind of tweaks right before the tournament. And the time between the win against Utah on Saturday and the Thursday game at 2:30 PM against UCLA, they had made some tweaks and they'd made some changes, and it's played out. And they actually played pretty well defensively against Utah in that game. But you look at the stretch of games that they played, you know, leading up to the Utah game against Colorado when they lost, that, you know, the Buffs shot 55% from the field. Arizona shot 60% from the field. That's bad. I mean, Oregon State in a win shot almost 50% from the field a couple weeks ago. They made some changes here, and you're right. Like, as much as we talk about Dante offensively, he changed the game defensively. And then their matchup 2-3 zone was tremendous. Colorado shot just 41%. Arizona shot 38%. And by the way, Arizona shot a season low 47 shots. They averaged like 60 a game. And Oregon shrunk the game. And I know a lot of people kind of get frustrated about how sometimes Oregon, it feels like, goes into like a prevent offense where they milk the clock late. And maybe people are a little upset that it starts with like 6 minutes or 7 minutes to go in the game and whatnot. But Arizona's coach talked about it and Colorado's coach talked about it, both saying those were huge coaching moves by Dana Altman. They shrunk the game, they slowed down the pace, and they grinded, you know, Oregon's opponent down. They gave a lot of credit to that game plan and how effective it was with the zone. They're playing their best defense going into the tournament. They've found something that works. Jermaine Kuzner at the top, kind of that three-quarter token pressure zone press that we've seen Oregon teams do in the past. Shelstead's really quick. Aquindo has made some deflections. He had that huge steal and dunk against Pelo Larson off a deflection. This team's figured something out defensively. And look, like, maybe it regresses back to the mean of what they were. And they aren't, over the course of the season, they are not a good defensive team. But they're playing their best ball going into the tournament on that side of it. And that has to be, a factor. You have to consider that. Now, can you bottle it up? Can you capture it? Can you reproduce it? That's going to be the question for this team.
Yeah, and to your point about kind of them going to stall or they're killed 20 seconds off the shot clock offense early, that will work if your defense plays that way, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the reason you play that way, is because you're confident on the other end. And it bites you in the rear if you don't play good defense, because suddenly you're squandering leads. But with the way they play defensively, yeah, as you said, if they can carry that over into the NCAA tournament, and we'll see matchup-wise with South Carolina, looks like they're pretty guard-heavy, how that factors into it, maybe a little different matchup than what they've seen in the Pac-12 tournament, they can absolutely make a run based upon their defense, because that has been probably the biggest change from the really kind of rough stretch there in February to where they are right now.
I mean, their opponents in the Pac-12 tournament shot 17. Oh, this is going to be really hard math. That's 40. 17 of 62 from three. The 2-3 zone really messed up a lot of what those teams did. And think about the teams that they had to play against: UCLA, Arizona, and Colorado in the regular season. Oregon went 1-5. And they had one game that they were competitive really against. I guess two. The Colorado game at home was,
yeah, it was pretty close.
A competitive game. But they had like a 20-point, 30-point blowout loss at Arizona. At home against Arizona, they only lost by like 9, but that was a game in the second half. They were down by 20 at one point. They lost to UCLA by 8, but that was a game where in the second half they just did nothing offensive. They couldn't do anything well. And the defense has forced a lot of turnovers. I mean, they 38 turnovers in three games for their opponents. And I think another side of that is, to your point of, if your defense can play like this, your slowdown game can work. Oregon also only committed 21 turnovers. They had three total turnovers in that championship game and 0 points off turnovers for Colorado. And I'm pretty sure Oregon scored 26 points off turnovers against Colorado, who had 13. You don't want to get too excited that this is going to be the norm and this is what's going to show up in the tournament, but Oregon is playing its best defensive basketball. They've figured out of the season. They've figured out what works offensively. They've got a dominant big man. There's a lot of confidence. There should be a lot of confidence going into the tournament.
One of the other talking points I've seen from fans is, could Nate Biddle theoretically play? So no. I'm going to ask it to you, Matt. And that's an immediate no from Matt. I know Dana was also asked about it on Sunday after the selection show. What's kind of the situation there? What are you?
He's redshirting. Okay. He's redshirting. So he does look healthy, or I should say healthier. I don't know if the illness or whatever it was is cured. I would think he's positive. He's going in the right direction. He just looks different from a health standpoint. Like, you can tell when people look really sick. And then yep, people that are just healthy, he looks just better. You don't want to speculate too much about it, but he's not playing. He's redshirting. The plan is, so if he plays, you have to, and you want to apply for a medical redshirt, you have to find another reason to justify a medical redshirt. I brought this up with Canzano, though. I do think it's kind of BS that in football, once you get past the regular season, if you've redshirted, you can play in postseason games. And I understand, like, part of that's for attrition and, the physicality of the sport and having the available players to help for runs. But the numbers of guys that redshirt in college basketball are so low that it wouldn't really change much. Now, could he even play if they wanted to? Probably not. But I just, that needs to be a rule that's changed. Like, if you're, for whatever reason, redshirting during the season and you get to the tournament, you should be able to play just like they allow you to play from a football standpoint. The one that I was really curious about was Keyshawn Bartholomew. I saw him running up and down celebration on the court. I saw him running up and down in the locker room. He was very visibly excited, celebrating during games in Vegas. The injury happened. When was that?
Arizona game at home.
January 27th. Yeah. So we're almost 2 months since the fractured ankle. So I asked Altman, like, is there any chance, you know, it's been a while, like he could give you 2 minutes, a half. And he quickly shut that down. But what I thought was interesting, he said he's been in there. He's been in the treatment room. He's in there right now getting a lot, you know, getting work done. He's been very diligent on getting his ankle healthy and getting himself back and But maybe that's a precursor of what could be coming for next season. Because Bartholomew does have a free COVID year to use if he wants. Hasn't said what he's doing one way or the other. He did walk on senior day. We've seen previous players walk on senior day and then come back. I just thought that was kind of like, interesting. Like he's very diligent on getting himself healthy and getting himself back. Maybe he's going to come back for a fifth year. I guess it would be his sixth year of college basketball next season at Oregon.
A couple other things, just kind of looking ahead a little bit to South Carolina. Yeah. First off, Jermaine Cousinard, former school matchup. That could be kind of fun. I know Jermaine had some comments about that, that, you know, after the selection was announced on Sunday. Probably never thought he'd play that team again. That's my guess. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you, Matt, was, you know, you get into this tournament environment and you're hoping your core players show up. But, you know, and for me, I think right now, Shellstad, Cousinard, and Dante, those guys are pretty reliable double-figure scorers. I think all three games in the Pac-12 tournament, you can correct me if I'm wrong, they all got there.
Yeah.
You know, and Shellstad, we should note, has kind of refound some of his offensive confidence. He'd had a really sort of an up-and-down February and early March. He played really, really well in Vegas.
He hit some shots against Arizona and Colorado that you were like, oof, those are big boy shots that big boys only can hit.
Yeah, so he's starting to find – he seems like he's going into the NCAA tournament with his confidence. But if you take those three and feel like, I don't know, you're getting 50-plus points from those three per game, who else needs to step up offensively, do you think? Because it seems like there's options. Aside from Diawara, everybody in the rotation could go for double-figure points on any given afternoon or evening. But who do you kind of – do you have a player or two you focus on you think it's really important as a kind of a role player to have a big, big weekend?
I think the player that comes to mind right away is Kario Aquindo. Oregon has had basically zero production in January and February from its bench. Extremely up and down from this unit. I think it's very clear Brennan Rigsby has lost a lot of the confidence and the mojo that he had in November and December and the early parts of January. And Dana Altman's talked about like the importance, and I even asked him on Sunday, of Diawara, Rigsby, and Kario, and being able to get something out of those three guys. So I think the one you look at is it's Kario Aquindo. He had 10 points. He had some really good defense against UCLA in that quarterfinal game. He played 26 minutes. And then against Arizona, he had 6 points, and he played 30 minutes of action. He had a couple rebounds. He had a couple steals. His defense has improved a little bit. And then he played about 20 in the Pac-12 championship game against Colorado. Got to the free throw line a couple times. Had some really big rebounds. Again, he had some playmaking assists for some guys. I think Kario Aquindo is kind of turned into their most reliable guy off the bench at the very last part of the season. And this is a guy that can score a lot of points. Sorry, my cat is just absolutely freaking out.
I was wondering what that was.
I think Kario Aquindo could become the kind of like the X factor wild card piece for Oregon. And then if you want to look at it from a starter perspective, Kwame Evans. Like, it stinks because there's so few of guys. Like,
right.
You have such a tight list that you basically can name everybody. But I think Kario Aquindo coming off the bench, and then you look at Kwame Evans as a freshman, and if he can stay on the floor, it's so important. Like, obviously, Dante getting into foul trouble or getting hurt in the Arizona game. Like, those are things that, like, you have to avoid. And those could be backbreaker. But if that does happen, if something does happen to Nfale in the first round of the tournament against South Carolina, like, you at least know, hey, we've got options. We can put Kwame at center. We can put Mo Diawara and play him a little bit. He's had some moments that have been really good. He's also had some moments that have been really bad, but you at least have options. And then against Arizona, we saw Altman even go like super small ball and play Tracy at the five. They don't want to do that. They want to stay away from that. But you at least have a couple options for when Dante needs rest or has to come out because of foul trouble. When Kwame Evans has to come out in the first half early in the game with foul trouble because he picked up two fouls in the first 3 minutes of the game, that puts Oregon at a really bad disadvantage because now all of a sudden you don't have a traditional backup. His backup is either Jadrian Tracy, who's 6'5", and he is a solid athlete. He is a solid basketball player, but he's not Elgin Cook. He's not Dwayne Benjamin. He's not Dylan Brooks. He's not Paul White in terms of the ability to switch between small forward, power forward, center. You know, you get at a disadvantage. There's a step down from just pure matchups with Tracy on the floor. Now, he does help and bring some positive, you know, impacts in other areas by playing that small man four, but you're sacrificing with him having to play there. That's something that you want to do in short spurts. You don't want to have to play Kario Aquindo at the power forward spot, who's 6'3", or Jadrian Tracy at the power forward spot for a 12-minute stretch of basketball. So I would argue it's get Kario Aquindo, have him have some big moments as a small forward for you to help Jermaine Cousinard. Their athleticism together, their defense together can be pretty good if Aquindo is playing good. He's been very inconsistent defensively. And then the other one is Kwame. Can you keep Kwame on the floor? Can he play 20 or more minutes a game? Because when he doesn't play a lot of minutes, it puts Oregon at a huge disadvantage just from a matchup perspective, from what they want to do offensively. And, you know, scoring is almost for Kwame, I think that's just almost, it almost becomes a luxury. Like, he hasn't scored in double figures since he went for 22 in a win against Oregon State on the last day of February. And then before that, it was 15 against Washington on February 8th. So, like, he hasn't scored, you know, if you want to find his third time of scoring in double figures, it was January 4th against Washington. So he's only done it three times in the new year. So, like, the scoring, it's a luxury if you can get him to double figures. But it's with all the other things, the things that don't show up in the box score, of having another 6'9 guy on the floor with Dante is what's going to be pretty important for Oregon.
And both those guys, to your point, could have a game where something is working offensively, where right. They go for 14 points, and that is what kind of allows Oregon to separate. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's crucial going into this tournament that those kind of three offensive players who've been the engine.
They have to show up.
You know, yeah, because there's not a lot of alternatives.
Yes. Like, I think they could probably beat South Carolina if you look at it and say, okay, Cousinard plays a really good game and Dante is consistent and Shellstead has a poor offensive night shooting the ball and scoring, I think they can probably still win that game. But if it comes down to only Dante plays well offensively,
yeah,
or if only Cousinard plays well offensively, you know, then it becomes really difficult for Oregon to get out of that first round. You've got to have two of the three show up. And if one of them doesn't, then the hope is that collectively between Evans and Tracy and Aquindo, Rigsby and Diawara, that they can kind of maybe make up for the lack of scoring by the third guy. And that's probably more likely than Oregon seeing two guys struggle and Oregon find a way to win its opening round game.
Matt, you will be heading to Pittsburgh.
I am.
Tomorrow. So you will be boots on the ground for us out there on the East Coast. Have you been to Pittsburgh before?
You know, I actually was thinking about this. No, I've never been to Pittsburgh. And then I was like, is this the furthest east I've ever been? And then I quickly realized it's actually not that far from Cleveland.
yeah.
And Columbus. I've been to Columbus. You've been to Columbus. We've been to Columbus. So it's not the furthest east I've been. I've been to Florida. But I am excited. Like, this is a part of the country I've just never really been to. I've never been to Pennsylvania. I'm excited to get to Pittsburgh. It's going to be interesting. It's played in the hockey arena. The Ducks have had some success playing in hockey arenas before. 2019, when Oregon won 4 games in 4 days in the Pac-12 tournament, they then went to San Jose and played in, I think, the SAP Center in San Jose, home of the Sharks. And they got out of that and went to the Sweet 16. They played in the SAP Center as well in 2013 when they won the tournament in Vegas in 3 days and 3 games. They upset, I believe it was Oklahoma State in the opening round. And then they upset St. Louis in the second round to get to the Sweet 16. So Oregon's had some success playing in arenas. They played in Anaheim. They beat Duke in the Sweet 16 in a hockey arena. I think that was the Mighty Ducks venue. So they've had success playing in hockey's arenas. We'll see what this one's like. I'm excited to get to Pittsburgh. I leave as of this recording in less than 20 hours. So I don't have a hotel room booked. My press credential hasn't been officially approved yet. All that stuff will get taken care of, but I forget how crazy tournament travel can be of, oh my gosh, I have to go across the country and I don't have anything, but I have to go. So here we go. It's going to be fun.
And to remind you, Matt, if they somehow do get out of the opening weekend, you might have to fly somewhere else right after that. So get ready.
Hey, if that's the burden we have to bear, I will bear that for Oregon to get to the Sweet 16. But they've got a long ways to go to get there. But it's a run that I don't think any of us expected. It's a run that's going to be fun. I think the storylines are great. The matchups are going to be great. Oregon got – it's not favorable in terms of reachability for the team or reachability for the fan base. You have to go across the country. I'm sure the Pittsburgh alumni base at the University of Oregon is probably not very big. Yes. But I actually think, like, it's 50-50 at best or at worst. And honestly, like, I kind of lean – I bet you the number is going to be on Oregon's side by the time it tips from a betting perspective. I think considering everything you had to deal with from an injury, from an illness, from lack of development, from poor game management, from poor execution, the season that they had, and what they had to do just to get into the tournament, I actually feel like they kind of got a favorable matchup. You know, they go into a game knowing we've got a puncher's chance to win our first game in the NCAA tournament. Like, going in against Arizona, like, you knew, okay, Oregon's going to have to play really well and Arizona's going to have a bad night. And some of that was because of what Oregon did, but some of it was also because of Arizona just didn't play well, you know, and it's both sides. Both teams had impacts on that. And you know, Arizona plays one of its better games of the season instead. I don't think Oregon wins. And you don't think that going into South Carolina. Like, South Carolina plays one of its best games of the year, and Oregon does too. They're still going to be right there. They're very similar in KenPom. They're very close to one another. They're very similar teams, even though there's a big seed differential.
And we should note, last time South Carolina played, they lost by, I think, 29 to Auburn, who obviously is playing as well as anybody in the country right now. They won the SEC championship going away, but it's not like this team has been setting the world on fire. I think they finished losing like 4 of their last 7 games.
They are 5-4 over their last 9. And if you're curious, that means they started the year 21-3 at one point. They beat Vanderbilt February 10th by 15 points to improve to 21-3 They were a ranked team, and then they lost to Auburn. They got blown out by 50. Then they lost to LSU. They lost by 21. Then they beat Ole Miss. They beat Texas A&M by 2. They got a good win against Florida by 6. They lost by 7 against number 4 Tennessee. They lost in overtime. They won in overtime, to close out the regular season against Mississippi State. And then they won their first tournament game in the SEC and then played Auburn again. And Auburn trounced them, won by 21, going away. So this is a team that at one point, 21-3, that's damn good.
They were looked at as like a top 2 or 3 seed at that point in the brackets.
Yeah. So I don't care, you know, the level of competition or what. That's to go 21-3 is pretty damn good. But something happened in the last 3 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, where they're now 5-4 in their last 9 games. They're coming off a blowout loss. It'll be a challenge. It'll be a game Morgan has to play well in. If they lay a dud, they won't win. But it's an opponent that's beatable. That's all you can ask for.
Yeah. I'm excited. Thursday, 1 o'clock. Matt will be there. I'll be on my couch watching and hoping that there's another game on Saturday, potentially against Creighton, which would be absolutely Dana's nightmare. He has no desire at all to play his former school.
He even said as much. I think his verbatim was, "Oh, I hate that." And he's 2-1 all time against Creighton. That came the very first year in the CBI championship. Celebrate, hang your banners, tap the banner on you, leave your house. But he does not want to play them. He has already said it will not be fun if they do get there. He has a lot of respect for the place. He says he still watches them on a regular basis. He still roots for them on a regular basis. And he said it holds a very special place in his heart. And he said as much about Oregon. He said, when I leave Oregon, the way I talk about Creighton will be the way I talk about Oregon. It's not something he's looking forward to. And honestly, like, he'll probably get mad that I say this. I kind of hope to see it happen just to see him have to do the dance of the uncomfortability of him having the coach's former team, which would be pretty fun. So, but yeah, storylines are there. We'll be there. DuckTerritory.com. Read the work, read the coverage. Eric will be helping from remote as well. We were hoping we'd both be in Spokane, but maybe we both go to Phoenix. Let's just get crazy here and Final Four. Let's just pencil it out, all right?
If they make the Final Four, I will be with you in Phoenix. I'll just guarantee that.
All right, that's going to do it for us here on the Odds and Ovals podcast. Thank you for listening. We'll be back later this week with more football, with more basketball, and I'm sure more other items as well, with football, basketball, and baseball, and softball all going on this week. But until then, you've been listening to the Odds and Ovals podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.